Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Sharp China. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Bill Bishop. Bill, how you doing?
Hey, Andrew. How are you? I'm doing well. Hi, everybody. Hope you're all doing well.
Good. Yeah, I'm doing well also. It's a dreary day in DC, but that means it's a great day to be inside podcasting, you know?
Yes, it is.
So here we go. And, you know, before we get to the news of the day, I actually forgot to put this on the rundown and remembered about 5 minutes ago. We do have an update from last week. Several listeners responded across multiple mediums. There were comments, there were emails, there was a tweet. I think we can now say with confidence that the correct pronunciation is plenum, unless you disagree.
No, I completely agree. And I'm kicking myself because, of course, it really comes from the Latin and having, you know, taken 4 years of Latin in middle school and high school. Once I started learning Chinese, my brain's too small. I got squeezed out. But of course, it should be plenum. So thank you for that comment. And we will go with plenum and we will ignore the incorrect AI pronunciations.
That's right. All the chatbots got it wrong. Or I think two of the three chatbots got it wrong. Yeah. But the Latin geeks win the day for now.
Yes.
So with that said, let's get into it. It's time for some consultative democracy. We talked about the two sessions last week. The meetings have been underway for the last few days. So a few headlines to get us started here in terms of what we've learned thus far. China's GDP growth target for 2024 is set at 5%, and the inflation is targeted at 3%. There has been no giant stimulus announced, and markets have been down in response. There will be no announcements of a new foreign minister to replace Wang Yi, as we'd speculated might happen in our conversation last week. China on Tuesday announced a 7.2% increase in its defense budget, which is already the world's second highest behind the United States. And then Premier Li Qiang will break from the tradition of the past 30 years and won't be giving a press conference at the end of the National People's Congress. So among those headlines, what do you make of what we've seen so far? Where do you think we should start?
No big surprises in the premier's work report. The target of around 5% for GDP growth is pretty ambitious given, last year it was also around 5%, but they were coming off a very low base. This year, it's going to be much harder. Mm-hmm. The announced fiscal policy is not, again, it just leaves a lot of the analysts thinking that this is going to be a bit of a stretch. This is going to be a pretty hard slog for them to achieve actually around 5% growth. Mm-hmm. It's one of the reasons why very quickly you saw the Hong Kong markets sell off. The mainland Chinese markets were actually up at the end of the day, but that probably had to do with a lot of sort of state buying as opposed to positive investor sentiment about this report. I think it shouldn't be a surprise to people. It's really, the general tone of the work report was things aren't great, but our prospects are still very strong. We have the right leadership. We know what we need to do. We're going to work through these issues. And, you know, it's the same kind of messaging we got from, for example, the Central Economic Work Conference in December, Politburo meeting in January is what we hear repeatedly in state media. And so really, there were no surprises. I think there were still some folks hoping that there'd be some sort of bigger movement around fiscal stimulus that would change the general view that it's sort of grinding away as they sort of steady as they go, as they grind through all these problems. Anyone still hoping for that, I think, it really should probably just cast aside those illusions because it's pretty clear the government is going to be very restrained. You know, I was talking to someone earlier this morning and the word was really just like, it's just kind of a boring report. Mm-hmm. It's important, but there aren't any really surprises there. You know, we all have to parse through it. And I read through it once, but, you know, you got to go through it a bunch of times. But there's nothing in there that jumps out as anything that is surprising from what bits of the bureaucracy and what Party Center has been saying through various meetings over the last several months. It's really more of a sort of a crystallization of what they were doing anyway, what they've already said they were going to do.
Now I know why you were sarcastically excited last Monday talking about the two sessions. You texted me this morning, boring, boring, boring. So that's where we are right now. Can you put some of the numbers? Just for perspective, though, how seriously should we take the 5% target in terms of its grounding in reality or the inflation that's being discussed? Like, I was under the impression that there was deflation happening across China.
And well, so, not according to, I don't think deflation was mentioned in the premier's report.
Well, certainly not. Yeah.
And so they're targeting, you know, same as last year, they're targeting around 3% for the CPI increase. That seems a stretch, and, you know, 5% on 3% inflation, 5% GDP growth on 3% inflation is a lot more reasonable than 5% growth on deflation or no inflation.
Yeah.
And so, no, I think ultimately, you know, the 5% number, barring some sort of real exogenous disastrous event, like, for example, the pandemic in 2020, where they, you know, they've had to just cast aside the target or the targets, officially they will get to around 5% one way or another. Whether or not in substance it actually really is 5% will be debated endlessly. You know, even for last year, where I think the official number was 5.2%, you have good analysts who are very skeptical of that number. I think the lowest number came out of Rhodium, which was like, they think it was really 1.5%.
Okay.
So you know, there's always going to be, there are already people sort of saying the math doesn't work. How are they going to get to 5% given the fiscal
realities. Sort of
the special bond issuance, the thing they talk about in this report, does it really all add up? Again, I think the 5% is important inside the system. It's a signal inside the system. It's what the, you know, there had been talk years ago, where some people saying if China's really serious about reforming the economy, they'll get rid of the GDP growth target because it builds in all sorts of perverse incentives. But in fact, they've kept it because it's actually how the system organizes. And so this is how you get all the various levels of government and various levels of bureaucracy to focus. And so, you know, they need a number to motivate and to push the cadres. So even if it's at the end of the year, it's not really around 5%, it has everyone sort of working in the sort of general same direction. If they just really got rid of it, I think the system wouldn't really know what to do.
Okay. Yeah, no, that makes sense. I'm just trying to get a sense for how out of step with the economic realities on the ground some of the projections are. And it sounds like it's an open question, but there is definitely room for skepticism among international investors. Is that right?
Well, I think also domestic inspectors and investors in Hong Kong. I think there seems to be a disconnect between how the top of the leadership sees the economy and then people, businesses, investors see it. And, you know, that I think is reflected in the markets. And, you know, Hong Kong in some ways is a better reflection because it's not as distorted as the mainland markets. It's not as easily manipulated than the mainland markets are. And again, I think you'd say, okay, steady she goes, no surprises. You know, it's not collapsing. It's, you know, we've moved on from last summer's sort of, you know, back-to-back economist covers of various forms of China collapse to, it's not great. You know, they're grinding through lots of problems. They believe they have a plan to get through it, but it's going to be more difficult and more painful than I think a lot of people realized even a few months ago.
Yep. The other big headline that jumped out at me Monday morning was that there's no press conference coming from Premier Li Qiang. And in talking to you last week, I came away with the impression that the National People's Congress and the two meetings more generally carry a lot of symbolic significance. And it seems in the reactions to this press conference being canceled that too carried a lot of symbolic significance. So what do you make of no appearance before the media from Premier Li?
Well, I think it's an unfortunate sign of the increasing opacity of the government and policymaking. But I also think it is just another sign of how the party is effectively eating the state. You know, the National People's Congress is the state. The premier, you know, runs the state part of the system. I think all of his predecessors since Zhu Rongji would give a end of MPC session press conference. You know, sometimes it was kind of unscripted. You got some interesting questions. The last few years, it's been pretty heavily scripted. But even so, it was a way for people inside China and outside China to see the premiere, see him take questions. And, you know, this is, I think, just another sign of a kind of a diminution of the importance of the State Council and the NPC and the premier's job. And I think also it's a sign that, you know, this premier, Premier Li Qiang, he gave the press conference last year. So he did it in his first year as premier. But I think it's a sign of him just, and again, whether or not he did this because he, you know, he
wanted to,
he thinks this is what the boss wants, or he was told to do it. But I think it's a sign of being very careful to make sure that no one is under any illusions that there's any sort of a second or alternate power in the system, right? Because you had a lot of hopes cast on Li Keqiang, for example, right? In the year before the 20th Party Congress, you know, there were a bunch of leaks and sort of reporting about how, you know, Li Keqiang was trying to change policy and, you know, yada, yada, yada. And of course, at the end of the day, when you got the 20th Party Congress, it was, you know, basically the sort of she ran the table from a personnel perspective. And pretty much everyone who was affiliated or associated with Li Keqiang was either out of a job or demoted or just sidelined somewhere. And, you know, and then of course, when Li Keqiang died last year, there was a real outpouring of grief. And I think that, you know, there's a chance that that also was sort of a reminder that that premier, his status has gotten too big. And so from Xi Jinping's perspective, you know, you just want to make sure that the premier job is basically like another minister. It's not a second, almost like general secretary kind of job.
Yeah, no, I mean, Ling Ling Wei at the Wall Street Journal wrote, the move is in keeping with how Xi has torn down the pillars of the Chinese governance model built during the Deng Xiaoping reform and opening era. Gone are the days when the premier, as the de facto head of the government, was given authority over economic policy while the party chief took charge of ideology and politics. So it's symbolism here, but it's just very grim symbolism to see Li Qiang recede to the background like that. Have we seen any photos of Xi yet? I know last week we said he'd been out of public view.
No, he's been around. He's been out a lot the last few days. And today we've already got, you know, one of the most important signals out of the two meetings is when Xi goes to these breakout sessions with various delegations. And so today he's already gone to a breakout session with the Jiangsu provincial delegates to the NPC. Xi himself, he's at this NPC, he's a delegate from Jiangsu. So it's his home delegation, so to speak.
Okay.
And, you know, all the meetings where Xi goes, you know, of course it gets massive coverage, but it's the propaganda pushes sort of what his key themes are, because his messaging meshes with the key priorities in the work report. Mm-hmm. And so this first meeting with Jiangsu was, you know, the headline in Chinese and English was Xi stresses developing new quality productive forces or new productive forces. And that is this, basically it's a sort of, they couched in sort of Marxist theory, but it's really about technological and innovation upgrading to make China a innovation and technology and a science and technology power, and to become more self-reliant in technology and to break through from, you know, they didn't say it specifically this time, though there was no mention of the US, but to break through the Western and especially American strangleholds on certain core technologies.
The other thing that you raised on Monday was the latest issue of Chiosha carries an article titled, How Should the Economic Situation Be Viewed? And you wrote, if you wanted an authoritative explanation as to how Marxist political economy explains why there is unlikely to be big stimulus forthcoming, this may be one of the clearest ones out there. And from the article, they write, the changes in the speed of economic growth are an inevitable reflection of the phased characteristics of our country's development, not subject to human will. It should be understood objectively and rationally, and policies should be correctly formulated based on this understanding. As General Secretary Xi Jinping pointed out, quote, it is not the case that a higher economic growth rate means the situation is very good, nor does a decrease in economic growth rate mean the situation is very bad. We must adhere to the correct view of achievements, not simply judge heroes by the GDP growth rate, and not be swayed by short-term economic indicators. We should focus on improving quality and efficiency to promote sustained and healthy economic development, pursue genuine, not inflated GDP, and seek effective, high-quality, and sustainable economic development. Lenin once pointed out that Marxists, and that's the end of the Xi quote, this is continuing in the article, Lenin once pointed out that Marxists, when analyzing a situation, should not start from what is possible, but from what is real. In analyzing the economic situation, we should also adhere to starting from reality, not from subjective desires. And you bolded that quote from Xi. I just find it striking alongside the months of speculation we've had about whether there may be a giant stimulus coming, because Xi seems pretty emphatic in terms of his dedication to long-term sustainable growth and not chasing the short-term indicators. It gets hard for him to be more explicit. Did you have any additional thoughts on what's happening there?
No, I mean, I think that this is something we've talked about before. I've certainly written about it in the newsletter. I think that, you know, a lot of people have come to realize over the last few months that actually she is very serious about this, you know, shifting to high quality, sustainable economic development. And, you know, it's going to be very painful. I think it's going to be more painful than a lot of people have realized. And that's part of the sort of hoping for stimulus, because things are going to be difficult for a period of time. And, you know, certainly from investors in the stock market, both onshore and offshore investors, I think, you know, they're hoping for more quick fixes, right? And mm-hmm. that's sort of, but that's not going to happen. I mean, that, they've been pretty clear that isn't going to happen. And so I think this report, for anyone who's still hoping for some kind of stimulus to save the day, I really think that they need to pay more attention, because they're very clearly telling everybody that that's not going to happen, and we're going to grind through these issues. And when you look at what they're doing outside of the economic realm in terms of really around sort of hardening all sorts of parts of the economy and society to be able to deal with a more difficult and economic situation, you know, I certainly believe that Xi Jinping, you know, at the top, they see things could get pretty difficult, and they know that, but they believe, or he believes, that they need to get through that to get to this sort of, you know, quote unquote, promised land of high quality development. Mm-hmm. And they're going to stay focused on that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just, I honestly come away reading that quote, and it's like, I want to make a public appeal to journalists to just append that quote to every article speculating about a stimulus for the rest of 2024, because it's hard to be any clearer than she was there. And then you juxtapose it with what's happening on the ground. Bloomberg had a story this week that was headlined, Xi's one-man rule over China's economy is spurring unrest. Thousands of angry retail investors last month flooded the U.S. Embassy's Weibo page with criticism of the government's handling of the economy in the midst of a $7 trillion stock rout. Compounding the problems is a broad drop in wages among civil servants, who have seen bonuses slashed in recent years as indebted local governments struggle to earn enough revenue. Quote, as long as my income was decent, I didn't complain, said Joe, a mid-level policeman in a southwestern city who has to be identified only by his surname. But now, he says, the economy is in bad shape. The leadership needs to show us some hope. So none of that is to suggest that there's some burgeoning uprising, but it's worth keeping in mind what that high quality development model actually looks like on the ground, because the pain is going to continue to broaden, one would expect, at least over the next year and more.
I think it's quite possible it will. And I think that they, but I also think that, you know, they have, that the leadership is aware of that, and they have all sorts of tools and mechanisms around social governance to keep, you know, it's not a binary, people are happy and everything's great, or they're unhappy and they go hit the streets, right? And they have a lot of ways to keep people from, you basically force people to, or prevent people from really, say, protesting or, you know, doing more than grumbling. And there's lots of grumbling. There's always been lots of grumbling. There'll probably be more grumbling this year, but there's a big difference between grumbling and something that becomes much bigger or more of a threat to the party. And I think we're a long way from that.
So when we talk about hardening the system, it can mean different things in different contexts, where sometimes if you're talking about hardening the system in advance of sanctions, it's controlling key supply chains and making sure that China can be self-sustaining in the event of some sort of isolating international incident. But hardening the system in this context is what exactly? Just heightened surveillance capabilities? And
Well, it's so even in the Roebuck report, there's a section on social governance. They talk about improving this Feng Chao experience, which is this idea. It started under Mao in the 60s, but it's basically like pushing sort of community-based, now in the new era, it's really community-based policing and managing contradictions at the where they start, at the level they start, allowing them to sharpen or move up the system into other parts of the country. Mm-hmm. And in the Mao era, it had some pretty nasty outcomes in terms of sort of mass events and people versus people. In the Xi era, it's more about a more institutionalized approach, but it's one of the tools that they're really honing as part of what they call this Peaceful China Initiative to, again, improve the improve social governance. And social government has a lot of elements. Some are positive around education, taking care of the elderly, childcare. I mean, but some are in the more sort of harder or coercive areas around security.
Okay.
And, you know, so they've got a whole bunch of levers there. You've also got, in terms of hardening, for example, the financial system, where, you know, one of the things they talk about again in this work report is, you know, making sure they deal with risks and financial, you know, risks around the financial system. I forget the exact language, but that's I'm paraphrasing here. They know they need to continue to try and clean up the financial system, deal with a lot of the risks related to real estate debt, local government debt. So again, it goes back to like reading this report. On the one hand, they talk about the challenges and the difficulties they're facing both domestically and in the external environment when it comes to the economy. On the other hand, it is it's a very ambitious document, like a lot of their documents, in terms of how they want to transform the economy, what they want to do for the PRC and for PRC citizens. I mean, it has a, whether or not they hit it, and, you know, some people, you know, just from reading it, you can see that they are projecting confidence that they can achieve these goals, even though it will be difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Now, plenty of people will quibble and say, well, they can, and it's, you know, the numbers are fake, blah, blah, blah. Leaving all that aside, it is actually quite, I think, from the party's perspective, it's quite a positive document.
Right. Yeah. I think what's striking and prompts a double take as an outsider is it's just a departure from a lot of the conversations that you and I have been having about the state of the economy and the outlook, at least near term, after the last 6 months or so. It's now all about ambition and everything that's going to be achieved this year.
But it's every year. It's like, I mean, the thing is,
yeah, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, they don't come and say, "Oh, we're screwed." Right?
Yeah, you guys are right.
I mean,
the collapse is coming.
This is, again, I think it's just, you know, and we've made this point on this podcast and the newsletter too. I mean, you know, you go back to what at the Central Economic Work Conference in early December or second week in December, and you go back to that readout and the propaganda around it. You know, if you had really dug into that, there's really little to nothing in this work report that would surprise you.
Right. That's
new. They're very consistent. And it goes back to, you know, they laid out the priorities for economic growth for 2024 back at this December 2023 work conference. You know, yes, the stock market had a real rough period in the first, you know, end of December into the first few weeks of January, but otherwise the data wasn't a surprise. So it's not like they would, you know, suddenly hair on fire, we got to change everything because, oh my God, it's collapsing.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's very much their problems, the belief that their problems, we know what they are. We have a view. We have a view of how we're going to get through these, and we're going to buckle down, and it's going to be hard, but we're going to grind through these problems.
Yeah, no, Beijing seems to have been clear-eyed and consistent on all of this for months now. It's why after our talk last week, I came away with the impression that, all right, most of the key decisions were made months ago, and this is more of a symbolic.
Yeah, and that's the other thing which is interesting too about sort of the earlier discussion around, you know, no longer having this, the premier's press conference. And then yesterday, the spokesperson for the NPC also said that it won't just be this year. It'll be years in the next few years, unless, I forget the exact word, but like special circumstances. But it's also this NPC started yesterday, the 4th. It ends on the 11th. It's 7 days. It's much shorter than it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so there was a period in the pandemic.
It used to be what? Two weeks?
Close to 2 weeks. In the pandemic, it was shortened for pandemic reasons, but there's no reason to do that now. It really seems like this is just it's kind of being condensed, both in terms of length, but also in terms of it's still important. It's an important part of, you know, what the party calls its whole process democracy. But again, it has a relative, I think, just in the Xi era, it's just relatively less important. And that's right. By design.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, back, you know, in the day before the Xi era, the MPC, the two sessions, 2 weeks where you had the CPPCC meeting and the MPC meeting, they were like party time in Beijing.
Interesting. I mean,
it was, corrupt. People would come, they would like, the delegates would come. And I mean, I had friends who were, you know, they were effectively like Chinese lobbyists in the sort of the Chinese lobby way. You know, they go golfing, they go help them buy real estate, you know, like crazy gifts, all sorts of wining and dining. It was nuts.
Yeah.
Right. That is not, and you know, frankly, for the better, that is not how it is today. I mean, it was out of control.
Well, trade-offs and everything, but yes, I would say that's not the vibe I've been getting from the reactions in the early days of this year's two sessions. Did you have any final notes, or should we leave it on boring, 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 and the days of partying?
I mean, there's also some changes to this, like National People's Congress, I think, or was it State Council Organization Law, which you have to parse
through.
I saw
that, yeah.
But again, it's elevating the party and elevating Xi. It's all about, like, a lot of this, what we're seeing is just sort of a general reduction in the state or the importance of state versus the party, with, of course, Xi at the core.
Right. A lot of gratitude to the General Secretary Xi Jinping.
Well, he's at the helm, thankfully. I think that was the opening couple paragraphs from the work report was, I'll give you the quote, because I think it does matter. Fellow deputies, we owe our achievements in 2023 to General Secretary Xi Jinping, who is at the helm charting the course. To the sound guidance of Xi Jinping thought on socialism with Chinese characteristics for a new era, to the strong leadership of the Party Central Committee with comrade Xi Jinping at its core, and the concerted efforts of the whole party, the armed forces, and Chinese people of all ethnic groups.
And also to General Secretary Xi Jinping. Yeah.
Yes. And I mean, this is not necessarily new language, but it is a reminder that, you know, they've become helmsman adjacent over the last few years in terms of talking about Xi Jinping. Mao Zedong, of course, was the helmsman. And
yeah.
And so they've been using a slightly different Chinese term for helmsman, but there's a lot about, you know, the run-up to the 20th Party's Congress, there's a lot about navigation and the navigator and helming. And it was very, like, for people who lived through the Cultural Revolution or spent a lot of time around Cultural Revolution language, they're very strong echoes of the way Mao Zedong was talked about.
Yeah, I mean, it's disturbing in that respect, and it continues to further concentrate, and the results on the ground have not been positive. So a lot of the themes here continue to be fairly grim.
But like the industrial upgrading, sort of building, you know, the sort of a modernization of Chinese characteristics, modernizing the industrial system, which are, of course, also key themes of this work report. And when you look at, you know, modernizing manufacturing, I mean, you look at a massive success, for example, that came out of industrial policy and then, you know, combined industrial policy with subsidies and foreign partners and foreign know-how, and then amazing Chinese entrepreneurs is the EV industry.
Yeah. No,
you look at that and it's a success. The solar industry, that's a success.
No one would argue that it's all bad, but when you talk about like the Marxist political economy relative to the last 30 to 40 years in China, I think embracing aspects of capitalism and blending with the West has seen some of the most prosperity that China has seen in hundreds and hundreds of years. And so Xi deviating from that so dramatically is continuing to send shockwaves through China.
Well, and I think, you know, one of the questions, right, and this goes back to it's almost like, I mean, there are lots of debates, is that, you know, are they really Marxist? Does Xi really believe in Marxism? Or is, for example, talking about, you know, new productive forces as a new leap in like Marxist productivity theory, or Marxist political economy in the context of that Chiusha article. Is she really a Marxist, or is this just cover for what they need to do?
What they need to do to concentrate power and secure the state?
Right, because they're a communist party. Like, they are the communist party of China.
Right.
Right? They have to, this is their dogma, right?
And Cite so, Lenin. That is, can't go wrong.
You know, that is still the sort of, there's still a debate. Like, well, they don't really mean it. It's not really Marxist versus, you know, but it's, they need this because what else can they, how else can they couch what they want to do versus, you know, maybe she's a true believer. Maybe not a lot of people don't believe it, but she might. And that is, I tend to fall on the, she looks more and more like, I mean, he just, maybe he really is a true believer.
Right. Well, he's certainly a true believer in his own authority and his vision for the future. And that has been the theme through the first couple days here. But on that note, let's shift gears to the international stage. One tweet from Tom Shugart, he quotes an article from this week that says, four Philippine Navy sailors sustained minor injuries after the two Chinese cutters used water cannons on Uniza March 4th, shattering the wooden supply boat's windshield. And then Tom adds, China outwinning hearts and mind in the region with their win-win cooperation. And Bill, I don't really have anything new to say about what's happening between China and the Philippines in the South China Sea. I just wanted to note that incident for the record because, A, every week when we're prepping this show, there are disturbing incidents like that happening in the South China Sea between China and the Philippines. And then, B, the video of that most recent incident is maybe the most shocking media I've seen from the Philippines thus far, just in terms of dangerous PLA intimidation tactics.
And according to the Philippine side, four of the crew were injured by flying glass. You know, they blasted through the windshield of the boat. It's a pretty disturbing video. It's a pretty aggressive action by the Chinese Coast Guard. It's again around the Sierra Madre, the grounded vessel at Second Thomas Shoal, and you know the Philippines are. I think they were doing a crew rotation. Another boat was there was a ramming or a collision, and you know and this is also going on while Australia is hosting this ASEAN Australia special summit in Australia, and it's quite remarkable that the Chinese, you know, again they. Somebody's going to get hurt, and then it's going to be really hurt, and then it's going to become a real problem.
Right. And for anyone who's new, because this is going to be a public episode, there is contested territory in the South China Sea. Most of the international community agrees that that territory belongs to the Philippines, and China has been intimidating Filipino vessels for years now, and that behavior has escalated, and the Philippines have responded with a campaign that they describe as assertive transparency, basically broadcasting PLA tactics. And this latest video, someone is taking video inside the ship as China is blasting this wooden ship with water cannons, and then the glass just explodes onto the person with the camera. And I came away from the video just very uneasy about how close we are to this conflict escalating to a point where I don't know whether the U.S. would have to intervene. I don't know what it looks like if it gets any worse than it already is, because it already is pretty bad and dangerous as it stands right now.
Well, U.S. and the Philippines have a treaty. And, you know, the question is, I think it's invoked that if there's an armed attack. And right. The question is, I guess, water cannon is not an armed attack. You certainly don't want to, I think the U.S. doesn't want to consider an armed attack. But at some point, if somebody dies in one of these encounters, because the Philippines clearly aren't backing down, it's one of the more dangerous flashpoints in the South China Sea right now.
Yeah. Yes. So we will see. But I just wanted to note it, and we'll include the video in the show notes for anybody who's curious. Shifting gears now to the United States. On Thursday last week, President Biden announced an investigation by the Department of Commerce into the potential national security risks posed by connected vehicles. As Biden said in the statement announcing the investigation, quote, China imposes restrictions on American autos and other foreign autos operating in China. Why should connected vehicles from China be allowed to operate in our country without safeguards? So today I am announcing unprecedented actions to ensure that cars on U.S. roads from countries of concern like China do not undermine our national security. I have directed my Secretary of Commerce to conduct an investigation into connected vehicles with technology from countries of concerns and to take action to respond to the risks. What do you make of what's happening here? Before we get into the PRC response, mechanically speaking, where do you think this could go?
Well, I think it's not surprising. This has been rumored. I think Bloomberg had a story about it early in February, and it's certainly been rumored around DC for some time that they were getting concerned about, getting concerned about the possibility of a surge of imports of PRC vehicles. Mm-hmm. And even though I think there's a 22 or 23% tariff on them, you have BYD and other Chinese auto companies looking at setting up factories in Mexico, and then if they assembled there, they could get around the tariffs. And so I think there are trade concerns, and this is using this national security approach allows you to get around that. But I think also the quote from President Biden, that comes straight from, I think, the way that the PRC has been restricting access to Teslas in certain areas,
right?
Where the PRC security services have made very clear that they consider Tesla vehicles to possibly basically be, rolling spy machines. The mm-hmm. way they, that you can't get within a certain radius of where Xi Jinping is when he's on an inspection tour, or can't be at certain SOEs, or, and so they're telling the U.S. government what they believe
this
these cars can do.
This is what they can be used for.
Right.
Yeah.
And so if you're the U.S. government, you're on the national security side, that's your responsibility. You can't look at what the PRC is doing around Tesla and argue that, oh, they would never do it with their own car. So the PRC has gifted this national security argument to the U.S. Legitimate or not, it's very, very hard, and I think legitimate that these things can be used for that. Whether they are or not, we don't know. Mm-hmm. But the momentum and the pretext on the U.S. side is there. And so this, I think, is going to go forward in a pretty, I think it's a 60-day period for this study. There'll probably be a lot of lobbying. I mean, U.S., on the one hand, there's a domestic political element because it helps protect U.S. carmaker jobs. On the other hand, companies like Tesla, GM, and they have a lot of revenue in China that they could be at risk if the PRC government decides to retaliate.
Right.
You've also got some companies, I think, like Tesla, NVIDIA, where they're doing a lot of software development around autonomous vehicle systems. What do they call them? The ADAS systems, I think is what they're called. Where if the U.S. government comes back and says, there can't be any hardware or software that has a sort of a PRC connection, then you're going to have to bifurcate sort of, you're going to be one set of software for like cars in the PRC or outside the US and one set for cars in the US. And not every car maker is sort of mixing the code, but I think there are some. And so this will be a problem for some car makers, may also be a problem for some of the European car makers. So it's, but what I heard sort of the view from the Biden administration was basically that they believe they need to get ahead of this before there are too many of these cars here, because they don't want it to be another Huawei situation where it becomes really expensive and hard to remove these vehicles if there really is a problem. And so they're trying to get ahead of it.
Right. Once people have cars in their driveway, it's much harder to roll back any of it.
And it's an election year. So again, there are real domestic political imperatives. This helps probably in Michigan. But again, is it just PRC cars, or is it components in cars from other manufacturers that, for example, allow the cars to be connected, like modules from something like Quectel that are also a problem? And so those modules need to no longer have any PRC connection. I mean, there's a lot that could come out of this investigation. We'll see. But I think it would be shocking if they announce this and then it fizzles out. So I think there are going to be, I think companies should be, some of these companies, I think, are concerned, rightfully so, about retaliation. In the the reactions so far have been, you know, as expected. And, you know, Apple, I mean, there was two different foreign ministry officials invoked Apple and iPhones as sort of spying machines. So that's right. Probably not great.
Well, yeah. I mean, Gina Raimondo was on NBC and said, if you think about it, cars these days are like an iPhone on wheels. And then the PRC spokespeople were using that remark against her, saying, kindly remind Secretary Raimondo that iPhones are American products. Were you suggesting that iPhones, Tesla, and even Boeing have been sending secret data back to the U.S. and could be shut down at any time by Washington? So that's a not so veiled threat at retaliation there. China would also have a lot of incentives to not retaliate against Apple. It'd be interesting to see how they respond depending on what the U.S. does here.
Yeah, I think we'll hear a lot of sort of veiled threats and comments, but nothing, no substantive response until there's actually something of substance from the U.S. side. Yeah. But again, one of the risks too for the Chinese vehicles is whether or not the U.S. actions then open the door for the EU to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's even harder on the EU side because the German auto manufacturers make so much money in China that they are resisting, even though it basically they will be, their businesses will likely be significantly damaged by Chinese imports into Germany and the EU. They have been so far resisting any actions against these exports of Chinese vehicles because they have so much business to lose in China. It's very messy.
Well, and it's high stakes because this is also, China is trying to grow its economy by exporting because the domestic demand is diminishing at the moment here. And so it's interesting because, I mean, for at least in the United States, restricting the influx of Chinese EVs, like you can see it in another quote from Biden, China is determined to dominate the future of the auto market, including by using unfair practices. China's policy could flood our market with its vehicles, posing risks to our national security. I'm not going to let that happen on my watch. He adds posing risks to our national security, but China determined to dominate the future of the auto market is its own motivation, including by using unfair practices. So the policy, whatever it ends up being, will clearly serve two purposes where there are probably real security concerns. And then it also does protect the American auto industry from being hollowed out by state financed competitors from the PRC. And so it seems to me on either basis that it would make sense to limit what's coming into the country. And I guess we'll just have to see logistically how it works, because as you said, the components, if security is the priority, the components that are going into cars that aren't necessarily Chinese made are just as important to be scrutinizing and potentially restricting.
Yeah, because a lot of us already have, you know, if you bought a car in the last few years, it's already connected.
Yeah, and it's all software. I mean, yeah. Like you think about getting in your car and, you know, immediately you plug in your phone and it has everything about you. So that's just sort of the reality of how we live now. What do you think the lobbying effort will look like? I mean, do you expect it to be as much of a knockdown, drag out fight as the chip ban turned out to be?
No, I think the chip ban, there were not many companies that were lobbying in favor of those bans. Here, I think you'll have more folks who see the net benefit to them, to their businesses, of this kind of a ban.
Okay, makes sense.
And no, it's just, I think, you know, it's another step in the sort of the reversal of globalization. And I think, you know, the thing that things are happening much faster now with Chinese. You know, the Chinese have moved up the industrial value chain. You know, these cars are very good. They're very cheap. You know, CNBC had a story last week. They sent their auto reporter to Chile. And, you know, lots of Chileans are buying the Chinese cars because they're just 20-30% cheaper and they're good enough.
Mm-hmm.
If in some cases, not better. And so, but most industrial companies don't want to lose their auto industry. You know,
right.
So Germany, South Korea, Japan, the U.S., you know, it's not going to be allowed to happen from a political perspective. And so this is going to, these forces are all going to be colliding in the next few months.
Yes. Well, elsewhere in Washington, as we were coming on to record here Tuesday afternoon, news broke. I'll read from The Verge. After a long reprieve from serious congressional scrutiny, lawmakers are taking another crack at getting TikTok to sever ties from its Chinese parent, ByteDance, the leaders of the House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party, Chair Mike Gallagher and ranking member Raja Krishnamoorthy, announced the introduction of the Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary Controlled Applications Act. The bill, which has 19 lawmakers signed on so far, would make it illegal to distribute apps controlled by ByteDance, including TikTok, unless they sever ties from the Chinese tech giant. So here we go, Bill. The movement to ban TikTok is being resurrected, ban or forced divestiture.
And quite quickly, I mean, this bill, and we can, it's not very long. It's, I guess it's getting a markup Thursday. So it's this joint, it's coming out of both the China Select Committee and the, like, the House Energy and Commerce Committee, I think. And it has bipartisan support. We'll see. You know, I mean, again, we have had discussions about this on this show, and we did it with our three-way with Ben back in November. We'll see how far this bill gets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things it could change is have some of the big lobbying shops and PR firms and law firms in DC, have they dropped ByteDance and TikTok as clients?
Right.
As some of them have dropped other PRC firms in recent weeks. And if they have, and if there has been pressure on the Hill on these companies to basically say, if you're representing ByteDance and TikTok, then we're not going to talk to you about anybody. If that lobbying chain is broken, then perhaps it will make more progress.
Yeah. I mean, we mentioned a few weeks ago that Anita Dunn's former lobbying firm, SKDK, was working on behalf of TikTok at one point. Who knows what the relationship looks like now? The Biden administration joined TikTok a couple weeks ago and immediately encountered backlash.
Well,
the Biden campaign. And yeah, we've talked about it in the past. It just does not make sense to have an information weapon that powerful in the hands of a foreign adversary. Like, it's pretty simple. I mean, I don't understand.
Congress has certainly been dysfunctional. Maybe this is a, you know, maybe ByteDance, TikTok is the thing that forces some functioning. I think it's, you know, it's got to get through the House, then it's got to get through the Senate. Then it's got to get, you know, there's a lot of steps in the process from putting up a bill to actually turning it into law. What's interesting is the way it's written is it would effectively force, like, Apple and Google to stop offering it in the app stores,
which would be the most efficient way to ban it.
Yeah. And they basically, if you're violating the law after a certain period, they'll fine the companies $5,000 times the number of users in the US.
All right. Let's increase the tax base.
5,000 times 100 million is how much?
Yeah. Apple can afford it, frankly.
No, but I even so again, this is for the sort of those who want to either ban or force a divestment of TikTok from ByteDance. This is progress,
mm-hmm.
but you know, it's like they were first down on the 20. Now they're on like the 26 yard line.
Well, I don't know. I thought the game was over for a couple of years here.
So that's it's alive. I just think, and again, there was somebody who's on the China, the U.S. like Economic Security Commission, who was criticizing people who were like too cynical. I don't. Maybe he was subtweeting us. I don't know, because we've been cynical about how Congress's efficiency around this issue. But this is certainly something that the ByteDance TikTok folks will not be happy with, because it is a sign, I think, that their lobbying efforts have weakened a bit because they've been able to forestall stuff for a while.
Right. Well, and what I would argue is productive is to force a public discussion of these issues, because if you're the Biden administration or the Biden campaign, newest members of TikTok, you can't coherently on one hand say it's a complete national security threat, an urgent national security threat that we're studying because all this information from Chinese EVs could potentially imperil American citizens going back to Beijing, and Beijing could shut off Chinese EVs at any moment. You can't make that point and treat China like a foreign adversary and then say, oh, it's fine that they have control of the most influential social media app and information resource for Americans under 25. Like, you can't coherently make that case in public.
Cognitive dissonance.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, I put nothing past Congress and elected officials as far as cognitive dissonance is concerned. But I think it's good to continue to push on this issue because it is a national security issue. And speaking of good news, I don't know if it's good news, but it is an update on a conversation we had a couple weeks ago. Their BGR's public relations arm has stopped working for controversial Chinese LIDAR maker Hesai Group, a BGR spokesperson told Politico. Hesai, which was recently placed on a Pentagon entity list denoting ties to the Chinese military, was also dropped as a client of Brownstein, Hyatt, Farber, Schreck, and Aiken Gump Strauss last week after Politico reported that several members of Congress were considering banning lobbying firms that represented such Chinese clients from meetings.
No, there has been. I mean, that's that there has been.
There's been movement.
Movement on the Hill. And I think that that, again, if that happens to the folks representing ByteDance and TikTok, then we will have to probably change our view on the likelihood of this bill passing.
Yeah. Well, and it is difficult because the military-civil fusion is so expansive that even companies that aren't explicitly making military-grade technology can be leveraged to lobby on behalf of PRC interests or CCP interests, that is. So it, I don't know where you draw the line in terms of which companies are radioactive enough to not have
right.
any
I mean,
place in
ByteDance,
Washington.
TikTok haven't been put on an entity list. I mean, there's yeah. a... and so that... But again, you know, I'll be cynical. It's D.C. How much of this movement on the Hill towards this bill is actually because the Biden campaign went on it? And so maybe some folks who weren't that enthusiastic all of a sudden said this is a way to
yeah.
get the Biden campaign. I mean, you just don't know. So we will have to watch it and see how it progresses through the markup Thursday and sort of where it ends up. But it is movement, and you know, I don't know. It's one of those things where you, I think, in a few years, people look back and say, "How did this happen? That TikTok got such a hold on Americans' minds?" It's quite amazing.
Well, and I think that that's certainly what the Biden administration is looking to avoid on the EV side in terms of letting Chinese companies take like significant market share and have a foothold in the American auto market before everyone realizes it's a problem and then it's too late to solve it. So it makes sense to be proactive on that front. But yes, we shall see. I won't be joining TikTok anytime soon. I know you have a no TikTok policy in your house.
Well, so if I sound a little shell shocked, some of you who've been reading Citizen for the years, I mean, you've heard about my kids over the years. This is a kind of a daunting week because they turn 18 in a couple of days, and so. I think I can't block them from having TikTok anymore. I don't know. It's,
no more authority.
All sorts of things change when they're actually legally adults, including I think my I don't know. If it's gonna be we're very proud of them, but it's quite a thing to have your kids become 18.
Yeah, look, it's been a big couple of weeks here because Tashi turned 5 years old a couple weeks ago. Your daughters are turning 18. My son turns 1 year old in 3 weeks or so. So yeah. We are on the other side of the spectrum there, but still, momentous occasions all around here. On that note, it's always great to see you. Hopefully, next week we'll have more exciting news coming from the remainder of the two sessions. I'm not going to hold my breath, though, but we'll keep it rolling regardless.
This day, the first day, is usually the most exciting, put it that way.
Yes, that's what I recall from last year. It sort of petered out. So again, not holding my breath, but we're coming back next week. And look, it was raining at the start of the podcast. Now it's sunny as I look outside my window. It's warm in DC. So things are looking up here.
Yes, they are.
I will talk to you next week.
Yes, thank you, Andrew. Thanks, everybody.